Again to BadQuaker.com podcast. Today is Thursday, May 17th, 2012. My name is Ben Stone, and this is podcast number 147. Yesterday, I had Michael W. Dean on the podcast. Michael W. Dean is from the Freedom Fiends podcast. He also does the, Anarchy Gumbo? Yeah, Anarchy Gumbo podcast. I think I said it right this time. And he does a bunch of other stuff, too. He has a live call-in podcast on Sunday evenings at 5 o'clock Eastern. You can find that on LRN.FM at the Liberty Radio Network. And he has a book out, and he does an audio version of that. I teased him yesterday that he's surpassing Stefan Molyneux as the hardest working man in the Liberty Movement. That's a fallback to James Brown. They used to say James Brown was the hardest working man in rock and roll, or actually, I think they called him the hardest working man in. I'm not sure. Anyway, but he was a hard working man. He danced. Anyway, all beside the point. So Michael took me to task on something that I said the other day on a podcast. A difference in the meaning, or possibly the original intent of the word bear in the Second Amendment, where it says that we have the right to keep and bear arms. And I had said in a podcast, I had used it in the context of to bear something, as in to bring it out of its hiding and to bear it. Whereas Michael was pointing out that he believed the context was to bear it, as in to carry it, and so I wasn't really sure, and I kind of scolded myself because I thought, well, I really should have looked that up and not gone with my own thoughts on it. So I used two different sources. I have an old dictionary. I have a couple old dictionaries, actually. I have one really old from the 1800s, and I also have one from the late 60s. And the advantage to these is that, you know, language changes pretty steadily. But, of course, the problem with a dictionary from the 1800s and one from even the 20th century is that it doesn't necessarily reflect what the attempt was to convey in the 1700s. So anyway, using the internet and using my dictionaries that I have here, I wasn't able to come to a solid conclusion. I am writing an article, and I had intended on expressing in that article the folly of trying to write laws out, and how and why this is ineffective to actually write laws. And so I'm going to read to you, using the research that I have done within the last 24 hours, sparked by Michael Dean's criticism of my word usage there, I've added a couple paragraphs to my article that I'm writing. So let me just read to you those pertinent paragraphs in that article, and this is the result of the research I've done in the last 24 hours. And so this is a quote from the article. "This brings up the folly of assigning groups of people the responsibility of writing laws and then expecting those laws to produce anything remotely similar to the results the laws were intended to produce. The perfect example of this is in the Constitution of the United States. Of all of the Bill of Rights' confusing terms, the simple word bear in the Second Amendment is an example of this principle. Bear, in this context, is a verb, the action of bearing. The oldest root I can find comes from Sanskrit, having to do with the final act of pregnancy, to bring forth young. Therefore, to bear is to bring forth into the open. In the 1700s, however, its common usage in English shifted. Let me interrupt here. What I didn't say in this is that a version of the word bear comes to us from northern India up into the Himalayas, where Sanskrit originally had its origin. The what's regularly called the Indo-European languages, which Germanic, all the Germanic languages come from this Indo-European root, come from the Kashmir area, of the Himalayas. So, and this is the origin of the original, all of the Germanic people had their origin in that area, and you can trace that out using language. So as these people migrated out of the area of eastern Afghanistan all the way into almost to China, there's like a bowl, if you can imagine, a giant elongated bowl that is Kashmir, pocketed in the western Himalayas. As these people migrated out of there and spread across western, what is today western Russia, and then eastern Europe and up into Scandinavia, they brought with them in one form or another their version of this Sanskrit, this Indo-European language. And so this word bear pops up in a variety of, everything from... pretty much all of the Eastern European languages, all the Germanic-based languages, all the way up into the Celtic languages and so forth. So it's a very, very old word. It's one of our, literally, it's one of our original words. It's up there with where we get the word milk and mom, mother, come from the same original Indo-European root. And bear is one of those original words. It's literally one of the early words that is almost universal to a lot of languages. And its actual origin is in the act of bearing a child. So in that context, it is actually to bring forth, as in to, if you would apply it to a gun, it would be to draw it from a holster or to draw it out to where it can be seen, not to be left behind. However, I'm going to go back to my article here in a second. I just want to point out that may or may not be what the writers of the Constitution intended. Let me go back to the article. Therefore, to bear is to bring forth into the open. But in the 1700s, its common usage in English shifted. Therefore, the intended usage in the Second Amendment is indeterminable, like much of the Bill of Rights. So did the writers intend to mean that the right to keep and bear arms was referring to something along the lines of bearing, as in to break free of its confines? Or did they mean arms could be bore like a load in a pack? And away from the article here, that would be like a mule bears a load. Can we bear arms, as in carry them in some type of a pouch or holster, perhaps either open or hidden, either way? Because technically speaking, a gun in a holster is still hidden. I mean, you can tell it's there, but it's put away, so to speak, so it's not being borne. But yet it is being borne because you're carrying it. So it can be taken either way. Okay, back to the article here. Or did they mean arms could be bore like a load in a pack? There's a vast difference between drawing a gun free from its confines, bearing as in childbirth, and having it inside a container, therefore easy to bear its weight. The writers failed to distinguish between simply carrying it and brandishing it. And my purpose in that, in the article there, is to demonstrate the folly of actually writing out laws and then expecting those, the intent of those laws, to be translated over time by different people. And as once I ever get this article published, part of the intent there is that communication itself is a very complicated thing. You're hearing my voice right now, and I can, just with the use of my voice, I can put fluctuations and emphasis on specific words, and my tone is extremely descriptive of the things that I'm saying, as opposed to simple text. And yet, even when you're hearing my voice, with all the inflections and all of the different aspects of my voice that you hear, the lack of being able to see my eyes and see my facial expressions and watch my hands, all these things are as intricate to communication as the words themselves. So yes, you know, we can express a lot of information by the simple use of words, but to only express information through the use of written words has a crippling effect upon communication. The perfect communication is when two people can look each other eye to eye, and they are within reach, and they can put their hands on each other and touch and express thoughts one-on-one. This is where true communication takes place. So then it's pretty ridiculous to think that we can take something as important as law, keeping in mind that law bears the burden of life and death. So if we as a society put the burden of life and death upon law, of actual confinement or freedom, if we put that kind of authority on law, and then we cripple it with this horrible limitation of only having it written in words on a paper, we've taken one of the most important aspects of society, law, and we've limited it in one of the most into one of the worst possible ways of allowing communication. Think for yourself how many times you've been chatting on the internet or talking to somebody through email or on a chat line or whatever, where you're just expressing through text. And think about how many times you've had how hard it is, how many times you have tried to express some complex thought, and how easily it's misunderstood, and how you try over and over, and or you see two other people chatting online somehow, and anger is flaring because they're talking past each other or whatever, and it ends up turning into sheer confusion because the two people are talking two completely different things, and neither can grasp what the other's talking about. Or sometimes they're actually saying the same thing, and yet missing the other's point and totally contradicting each other as they're essentially saying the same thing. So written text is a horrible way to communicate complex thoughts. And yet here we take one of the most important aspects of civilization and we entrust it to written laws. That's really messed up. I mean, that's like, Why would you do that? And yet that's what is accepted now. But law should be the most simple of things. In the olden days, and I go into this a little bit in the article. I don't mean to cheat the article and give it away, you know, completely on a podcast maybe weeks before I actually publish it. But if you think about how law was handled for thousands of years in Northern Europe and other places as well, Australia, South America, you know, much of Asia. The way law was handled in very advanced civilizations and very simple civilizations, law was understood among people. There was just a general understanding of it. And when someone felt that they had been imposed upon by someone else, or someone felt that there was a law breaker in their midst, then they would bring this before the elders of their group, whatever city or town or settlement or whatever, however big their group was, however advanced their civilization was, they would bring it before these people. And the goal was not to look something up and see what's written on a paper and then inflict that upon people. The goal was to discover what law was and then attempt to negotiate and figure out a way to bring law to bear on that situation. Oops, I said to bear. So that's the way law was. Even in England, all the way up into, they really didn't start writing laws as we know it today, well up into the 1600s before lawyers, before it became a profession and lawyers began establishing guilds and excluding some and including some, and they started getting the authorization of the state, and then they started writing things down, and law became perverted. So by the time the United States was formed in the late 1700s, the concept of law had already really lost its true meaning, and it became something that people write on a paper. And that's a horrible perversion of the traditional meaning of law. Law, before that time, was far closer to what we would think of today as natural law. Whereas once you begin to write it down, and you know, in language, like I was saying a minute ago, language changes dramatically, even from one generation to the next. We see this in common speak all the time, where words shift from one generation to another. And you can see this very clearly. For instance, I referred to that old dictionary I have. You can start looking up words in an old dictionary, and it's almost comical sometimes, the meaning, how the meaning has shifted. And that's why, I don't want to take away all the thunder from my article before I even publish it, but that's why it's just sheer folly to write down a law and expect its intent to be kept intact over time. As soon as you, there's an old parable. I don't know if this is actually, you know, what it's based on, but there's an old parable from, I can't remember now if it's Egyptian or if it's Greek. But in the parable, there are two great thinkers that are talking to each other. And one says, this new invention we have of writing things down is really great. It's gonna change civilization. It's gonna advance mankind. We're going to be able to record things by writing them down in words and have them for future generations. And the other thinker says to him, no, it's just the opposite. The act of writing, the more this habit of writing things down in words, the more it spreads, the dumber and the less capable mankind will be. He will rely upon these written words rather than his own mind. And the written words have limitations, but the mind has none, has no limitations. And so these two great thinkers were looking at the same thing and seeing two opposite reactions or results. They were seeing two opposite results. One was seeing that, yes, with this new writing that we have, we can record things for posterity. We can improve mankind. We can pass secrets on for generations that would otherwise be lost through oral tradition. And the other said, no, because when you write it down, you actually, in that act of writing it down, you limit the amount of communication it can carry. So anyway, so that was kind of a long-winded thing, but I felt like, you know, with Michael calling me out on that, in a friendly way, but with Michael calling me out on that, I thought, you know, I really should have researched that better to start with. And as it turns out, who knows? Who knows what they meant when they wrote that thing? They, you know, that Second Amendment is so, all of that, the whole Bill of Rights is written in a way that you can pretty much interpret it any way you want. Who knows what they actually meant? And as a matter of fact, it was written, and this is a fact. You can look this up. Go to Wikipedia, and you can find this for yourself. The actual Bill of Rights, one copy of it was written, and held on to by Congress. And then other copies were written and sent out to the various states. And each time it was handwritten, and there are variations of the actual text of the Constitution, there are variations that were sent to different states. So technically, when people got their hands on it and started to read it, oftentimes what they were reading in, let's say, New Hampshire was different than what they were reading in, say, North Carolina. And the reason why is because different people sat down and made copies to take back to their different states. And there was, it wasn't treated like scripture. It was treated as just a thing that we're writing down. We'll take this back and see we'll run it up the flag and see, or we'll run it up the pole and see who salutes it. But it wasn't taken at the time as some kind of holy writ that, you know, had to be in the olden days, back in ancient Hebrew times, when they would transcribe scripture to make copies of scripture. They were fanatic about making sure that it was copied exactly accurate, and there were just horrible punishments if a script being the person who was copying the script, if a script made a single tiny mistake, then he could face being beaten. He could face horrible punishments. He could be banished from the order. And this also carried over through the Dark Ages in monasteries, where monks would sit for hours on end and meticulously copy scripture. And usually an elderly monk would come around, and or a priest of some kind would come around and proofread what they were doing. And literally, if they made the slightest error, they could face a horrible beating. So there was this magnificent motivation to make sure that scripture was exactly copied from original to each new copy. But that wasn't the case with the Constitution, with the Bill of Rights. It was pretty much, let's scribble this thing out, and Bill writes it one way, and Tom writes it another way, and Jerry writes it another way. Or maybe I should have said Larry, Moe, and Curly, considering the people who were writing it. And I mean that in all seriousness. We're not talking about Jefferson here. We're talking about a mass of people with contradicting opinions, arguing and fighting and compromising, and then among them, some of them making copies of it and hauling it back to their states to see if they can get the thing passed or if it's going to be voted down. So there was very little consistency there in communicating the Bill of Rights. So, you know, technically what South Carolina was voting on could have had a different understanding. The voters in South Carolina, and it wasn't open, by the way, this wasn't open for the public. These were specific people who could vote. The vast majority of people were not allowed to vote on the thing. Specifically women, no either freed or bound slaves were allowed to vote on it. No one in Appalachia was allowed to vote on it. Of course, no Native Americans were allowed to vote on it. Only a very small group of elite family, members of elite families were allowed to even have a say in it one way or the other. So how is it that we could lend any legitimacy to this Bill of Rights, to this Constitution? I don't know. It's written so vague that it could be taken in any way to mean anything you want, and with ages, as I was saying a second ago, as the ages pass, the meanings of each individual word shift, and therefore the meanings of the sentences shift. And so do we go back and try to discover what the original intent of every single aspect of this thing was? Well, you know, at some point, this you just exhaust yourself trying to figure out original intent. And then you have people who say, well, but we can't actually go with original intent because they didn't have things back then like we have now. Modern society is so much different than now than it was then that how can these things apply today? And people, anti-gun people, will make this argument about guns. They'll say, well, it was a whole different society then. We had, you know, the threat of an Indian attack. We had, there were no cops on every street corner. Therefore, you know, crime could have taken place at any time, and people had to be able to defend themselves. And they make all these different excuses and to try to explain how society is so much different now than then. Well, if that's really the case, then why do we have that thing at all? Why would we carry something over for hundreds of years, pretending that it has meaning, if we ourselves admit that it has no bearing on today's society? So you can't have it both ways. You can't say, well, we're going to apply this to modern society, and then try to translate what it was that they were originally trying to say. But then you have to admit, too, that society has changed, and therefore some of these things have to apply differently. You know, you get into a series of spiral logic that just winds around in circles and can't ever come up with a reasonable answer. So what is a reasonable answer? Throw the thing away and realize what is natural rights. Realize what natural law is. If someone is walking around minding their own business, and they're not aggressing on anyone else, then it's no one else's business whether they're, you know, carrying, like Michael W. Dean said yesterday, if they're carrying a samurai sword or if they're carrying a pistol or if they're, it's totally irrelevant. It doesn't matter. If they're not aggressing on you, it doesn't matter. Oh, but they might have they have the potential of aggressing if they have a gun. They have the potential of aggressing if they have a rock. What, are you going to outlaw rocks? It's crazy. Everybody has the potential to aggress. Everybody has the potential to rob. Everyone has the potential to lie and to cheat and to steal. We all have those potentials. But it's not an aggression until we actually act upon those things. I may have the ability to steal, but if I walk into a grocery store, I shouldn't expect that I'm going to be harassed because I have the potential to steal, unless I actually steal. So it's the same thing with a weapon. If I have a weapon, whether it's exterior in a holster where it can be seen, or whether it's hidden away, or whether I've got it out in my hand, completely ready to be used. If I'm not actually aggressing on anyone, or if I'm not actively threatening anyone, then I haven't done anything wrong, and no one has the right to interfere with me. And there's your intent. That's original intent. I don't care whether it was the original intent of the authors of the Constitution, because I have no respect for them one way or the other. But that's the original. That's going all the way back to our ancestors and where true law came from. The intent of law is not to punish someone for their potential. The intent of law is to deal with what actually did take place, and was someone aggressed upon? Is someone's property damaged, or is someone affected in some way by your actions? If so, then the law has something to say about that, and the community is supposed to have that say as to what is to be done. But we've taken that all away, and we've given that to a small group of legislators. We've decided that certain people can have the responsibility to do what humans have no right to do, and that is to make laws for other humans. Okay, I'm going to break for our commercial, and I'll be right back. How would you like to support badquaker.com and get something nice for yourself at the same time? I want to tell you about Survival Gear Bags. It's run by my friend Kelly, who believes in and adheres to the non-aggression principle. Kelly's customers know him for his great customer service and his personal touch, because Kelly handles all customer service himself. The main focus of Survival Gear Bags is to allow you to build your own custom emergency kits with quality gear. Now, I know this because I bought my bug out bag from Survival Gear Bags over 2 years ago, and I've gone all over the country with it by my side. And you can rest assured that the prices will always be the best they can be at Survival Gear Bags. And if you use the link from badquaker.com, they'll probably throw in something for free for you with your order. Now, how do you do this? Well, it's simple. You go to badquaker.com. On the right side of the page, click on the picture of the backpack. Then look around at Survival Gear Bags and find the stuff you want. You'll help badquaker.com, and you'll support a merchant that's one of us. Now, I want to tell you about another way you can support badquaker.com and get something really cool at the same time. Shire Silver. Shire Silver is the proud seller of silver and gold trade cards. Shire Silver believes that silver and gold trade cards will show the world a better way to save, spend, and share precious metals. So what are silver and gold trade cards? There are specific weights of gold and silver laminated inside credit card-sized tradable cards. They're a handy and affordable way to trade precious metals. These cards received nationwide recognition when they were widely used as barter at the New Hampshire Porcupine Festival. You want a beer and a hot dog? Hand them a Shire Silver 5 card and get a Shire Silver 1 spot back as change. So again, what do? Well, you go to badquaker.com. On the right side, just below the backpack, you'll see the Shire Silver trade cards. Click on those cards and then check out Shire Silver's site. Be sure and watch Ron's video that's right there on the main page. And then swap some of those ridiculous Federal Reserve notes for something of real value. Something you can keep, trade, or give as the coolest gift ever. But be sure and use the link from badquaker.com. Thanks, folks. Okay, thanks for sticking with me through the commercial break there. I want to completely shift gears here in the second half of the podcast, and I want to go in a completely different direction. The Andrew Napolitano, the former, I believe he was a New Jersey Supreme Court justice, I believe. I think that's where he gets his title of judge from. But, of course, as a Quaker, not a good Quaker, but as a Quaker, I don't use titles like that. I don't recognize titles that men place upon themselves for the purpose of giving themselves glory. And I'm not saying that to attack Andrew Napolitano. It's an aspect of society that from, you know, I'm not trying to push this on anybody, but from my thinking, it's horribly offensive when people tape upon themselves titles, and they expect people to show them honor and respect because of this title. Like somehow a so-called judge should be given greater greater respect than, say, you know, a person who makes sure that your home gets electricity during the dead of winter, when you would literally freeze without it. How is this person, this judge, given more respect than an electrician who makes sure that life continues through the winter? Or, you know, or how is it that the doctor at a hospital, how is it that the doctor is so much more important than the janitor who makes sure that the environment that the doctor works in is sterile and clean? Because without the cleanliness of that operating room, everything the doctor does is without meaning. So how is it? And we say, oh, well, it's because of education. It's because of education. The doctor is so much more educated than the janitor. Really? You know, I've known a lot of janitors. I really have. And I've known janitors, and I've known a lot of doctors. Both medical doctors, and I've known people who had their doctorate in engineering. I've known chemists who were doctored, had their degree. And I can say that I've known janitors that were every bit as smart as some of the smartest doctors I've ever known. And I'm not saying that to put down doctors. I'm saying that the amount of education that a person faces when they, from the time that they become an adult until they go into the profession that they finally end up in, all of that time is education. And what you learn during that time is not dependent on how much money you pay a university. it's dependent upon the individual. So yeah, you could have a brilliant surgeon who's put a lot of effort and a lot of work into his education, and so now he is capable of doing some amazing things. I wouldn't trust him to wire my house, though. On the other hand, you know, if you have somebody who's spent 6 or 8 years in an apprenticeship in a machine shop that can just do amazing things with the machinery in a machine shop, that guy very likely has just as much true education as the guy coming out of medical school. It may not seem like that unless you actually get in there in that machine shop and start looking at all the complex mathematics that are being done and all the geometry that's being worked through. And when you start to grasp how complicated a machine shop can be, you realize that... Okay, interrupted mid-sentence there by a phone call. I had to keep the phone on because Kai...
Oh, I'm sorry, Baggy.
I got it. Things coming from every direction here. Something was tickling my leg. I didn't realize what it was, and I smacked at it and whacked the cat right in the head. I'm sorry, Baggy. Anyway, back to my original diversion from my original topic. So I had to leave the phone on because Kai, my sometimes co-host, is on the road coming back to Ohio from Texas. And so I have to leave my phone on just, you know, because that's what parents do. And so she just called in and she's on her way and she's doing good. Her car's doing good and all those kind of things. So anyway, so I'll try to get back into the discussion here if I can remember what it was about. I think I was talking about titles. I think I was distracting myself, actually, from my real notes, going off on a Quaker rant about calling people titles. So let's just cut that short and say, suffice it to say, I don't recognize people's titles. Oh, I know what I was talking about. The difference in, say, a machinist who works in a machine shop and somebody who wants us to call them, you know, your great and reverend doctor or whatever. When in all actuality, you know, and if you think about it too, from a machine shop point of view, let's compare that to a brain surgeon, or let's compare it to some other kind of really, really difficult type of profession that you need a very advanced degree in. But if that machine shop worker and all the people around the entire network of people who make it possible for that machine shop, for that machinist to do his job, if he fails, you can bring down an entire jetliner over one little part. I'm talking little. I know, you know, I've worked enough with jet engines to know that within them there's an unimaginable amount of tiny little parts, all of which are critical. And the level of precision that's put into the designing and the manufacturing of those tiny little parts is just amazing. And so you have a machinist who has never had any real formal education and yet uses complicated mathematics and a high level of skill and a high level of professionalism to produce a tiny little part that goes on an airplane that has to endure unimaginable stress. And then to think that someone, because they're a professor in a university or because they're, you know, because some guy handed them a piece of rolled up paper and said, congratulations, you have a fancy title. Or because, you know, for us as humans to take some people and exalt them simply because of silly things like that it boggles my mind why we do it. So I don't say judge so and so or your honor so and so or doctor so and so. I don't use those titles. And I'm not trying to disrespect someone who has, you know, dedicated their life to education, but at the same time, you know, I'm using the machinist as an example. We don't place any kind of titles upon the machinist who through his precision and work, maintains the safety of hundreds and hundreds of people flying through the skies or driving their cars or doing or driving across the bridge or doing any of the other things that that are made capable by his skill. Okay, so anyway, so let's get back to Andrew Napolitano and stop tearing down. I'll stop the Quaker preaching and get back to the point here. So Andrew Napolitano was recently did an interview. He was a guest on one of the shows on the Fox News or whatever. I don't know. You know, I don't actually watch that stuff. I catch chunks of it on YouTube occasionally as things go viral and they're being passed around. But I haven't actually watched national news of any kind in a very long time. It just disgusts me. But anyway, so Andrew Napolitano was talking about the drones, one of Michael W. Dean's, speaking of him earlier, one of his favorite topics. And so Andrew Napolitano was talking about the drones and said something to the effect of the first guy who shoots down one of these drones in his backyard because it got too close to the guy's children is going to be an American hero. And I contradicted that as quickly as I saw it. I contradicted it on Facebook. You know, it's easy to hear somebody say something like that and jump to your feet and cheer and say, yeah, that's right, we gotta shoot them drones down, yeah. But the problem in that kind of thing, and someone like Napolitano should know better than to say something like that out in public. That's what I call cheerleading. It's the kind of thing, it's the reason Alex Jones irritates me sometimes, is it's unnecessary cheerleading. I'm not slamming either Andrew Napolitano or Alex Jones. They both serve an important function, but I've just never really had an appreciation for cheerleading. Some people it serves a very important function, but it never has to me. But when someone like Napolitano comes out and says that the first person that shoots down a drone in their backyard is going to be an American hero, well, my comment in Facebook was something to the effect of, yeah, he's going to be dead is what he's going to be. You start shooting at drones and the government will kill you. That's what they do. They won't hesitate. They'll just take you down. You see, fighting the state on the battlefield that the state chooses, with the weapons that the state chooses, in the timing that the state chooses, is utter foolishness. We should always examine the battlefield, examine the tools that we're going to use, the weapons, and examine the timing. And if you pick the timing, and if you pick the weapons that the enemy cannot master, and if you pick the place of the fighting where the enemy is the weakest, then you win. But if you allow the enemy to choose the place of the fighting, the type of fighting, the weaponry used, and the timing of the battle, if you let your enemy do that, then you have lost the battle before you enter it. This is a very old concept. And so when we realize that the state is our enemy and we decide to take the battle to the enemy, it's foolish to fight the enemy according to the enemy's strengths. So, no, do not shoot down a drone in your backyard unless you want to die, unless you want to make a martyr of yourself and die. And I was talking about martyrs the other day. It's just, let me take this in a different direction. I've got some notes here. And so if this sounds mechanical again, it's because I'm cheating and reading off my notes. Jesus was murdered by an agreement between the Roman state, the existing Jewish state of the day, and the state-backed religion. Now, this is a three-part, Jesus' martyrdom was based on three different separate entities. You have, there was a local government that was the official government of the whole Palestine area. And they had a king and they had an entire functioning government that the Romans respected and did not infringe upon. Palestine was a separate nation at the time. And then there was the overseeing Roman government that was sort of an occupying force. You might think of it the way you know, the way the U.S. is an occupying force in a place like Iraq or somewhere like that, Afghanistan, to where there is a puppet government that's there, and they have the authority to act in certain ways, but yet there's a bigger, stronger government there as well that is pretending like they're not really running things, and yet they are. Well, that's what you had in Israel at the time. You had the puppet government there, Herod's old government, and then you had the official government that was represented by Pontius Pilate, who was the governor of the area as a Roman province, and then you had the religious leaders as well that had an influence on the Jewish state, on Herod's government, but they did not have an influence on the Roman government. But they were authorized. They were the authorized state-backed religion. And as a matter of fact, Herod the Great, which was, I believe, the father or grandfather of the other Herod, had actually built the temple for the priesthood, had rebuilt it. So anyway, I'm getting way too much into detail to say what I'm intended to say. Here's my real point in this. Jesus was murdered by a combination of the Roman state, the Jewish state, and the official state-backed religion of the day. Now, he could have fought. It was within the purpose, theologically speaking, it was within the purposes of his, you know, of why he was here and why his ministry existed, that he be sacrificed. That's part of the theology of it. But from a practical point of view, he could have fought. Jesus could have fought. Many of his followers were what were called zealots. We think of zealots today, we think, well, that's a person who's an extremist. But the word zealot that we use today actually comes from a Jewish sect that were called the zealots. And some of the characteristics of the zealots were that they always carried a dagger, and they had sworn that if they got the opportunity to kill a Roman or any Roman sympathizer, if they had the opportunity to do that and not get caught, that they were bound by their duty to their oath to kill that Roman or that Roman sympathizer. So they were fanatical in this way. And many of them were followers of Jesus. So Jesus had himself surrounded, essentially, by these violent radicals who were more than willing to make Jesus' cause a militant cause, to overthrow the existing Jewish state, to kick out the occupying Romans, and to overwhelm the state-backed religious authorities, the priesthood. These zealots were more than willing to give up their life. That was another aspect of being a zealot. They were what we would think of today as terrorists, in the sense that they were willing. Individuals had sworn the oath that they were willing to die for their cause. So Jesus had the opportunity to turn this into a physical war, to fight the Romans and to fight the Jewish state and to fight the priesthood. And an example of how effective that could have been, you can look at around the time of 64 AD, when the Jewish population, well, not the entire population, but mostly the zealots, rose up against the Romans. Sure, eventually the Romans won, but when the revolution first started, it wasn't clear that the Romans were going to win. It could have gone either way. And as a matter of fact, as many know, the zealots that went out and took the palace at Masada, which was actually Herod's personal palace, they went out and captured it and took control of it and held out for quite some time. Now, if those same zealots would have had a leader like Jesus as their militant leader, I don't know who can tell what the result would have been, but certainly one possibility is that the Romans may have backed off and the zealots may have won. Jesus may possibly have been able to overwhelm the Roman forces, kick the Romans out, establish a new government, you know, and establish a new priesthood. It's possible he could have done that. And then you take that to the temptation that was offered to Jesus, where he was taken up on the hill and he gazed out and he saw all the kingdoms of the earth, and supposedly Satan or Lucifer or whatever offered him to be king of the state, essentially, to be a statist and to have control of the state. And Jesus turned that down. Well, if you blend those two thoughts together and you realize that, yes, that was a capability that Jesus may have had, he could have ascended to Herod's throne and become a physical king of Judea. That's possible. And he refused it. He turned it down, and he accepted his death instead. Well, it's an interesting thing to think about. But it wasn't, you know, that was at a moment when Rome was either at its peak of strength or near its peak of strength. And by not doing that in the long run, Jesus' movement lived, whereas it may have died on that spot. If he had attempted that and failed, then there would be no Christianity today, just like there are no zealots today. You don't see the remnants, or you don't see a major religion of Jewish zealots today like that. So anyway, and this brings up a different topic altogether, and it's something that you hear kicked around on a real regular basis about Rome. People love to compare Rome to modern day America, and one of the frequent things that they say is that Rome fell because of its morals. There was greed and its moral corruption that caused Rome to fall. And this is really, you know, a lot of very respected people have made this argument, but in order to really believe that argument, that Rome fell because of its morals, you really have to ignore most of the history of Rome. You have to completely set aside most of the actual archaeology, most of the actual scientific research that's been done, and most of the actual history of Rome. You have to set all of that aside if you're going to accept the argument that Rome fell because of its morals. Because using modern-day Christian morals, Rome was about as corrupt and evil, you know, using those in context of today's Western culture, Rome was about as corrupt and evil from its earliest days as it was at any other particular time. Rome was when it was very small as a city-state, it was subservient to the Etruscans, and the Etruscans kept Rome in a subservient state until about 500 BC. And around 500 BC, Rome was able to gain its independence from the Etruscans, and it did so in a very bloody manner. The Roman fascist symbol, the bundle of reeds with an axe head shoved into the reeds, this indicates it's a fallback reference to, see what I was talking earlier, I'm waving my hands around as I speak, but you can't see my hands, so the communication is limited. But when the Romans were subservient to the Etruscans, they were not allowed to arm themselves openly. They were not allowed to carry swords and spears and weapons. So the way the legend works is that they would have since they couldn't have something like a staff or a spear or any kind of weapon like that, a bundle of reeds, though it looked just like, you know, almost like a haystack or whatever, but a bundle of reeds was strong enough that you could insert a axe head into it and use it as a weapon. So they use something, the intent here is, yes, we don't have an axe, we don't have a weapon, we don't have a spear, we don't have a sword, but we can use something that it appears to be harmless, and yet we can deliver a deadly blow with it. And the other intent in this was that even though each individual reed is weak, together we can stand up against the Etruscans and wield the axe and be strong. So this is where the symbol of the fascist came from, the fascist being that bundle of reeds with an axe head shoved into it. Okay, Rome broke free from the Etruscans about 500 BC, And it grew until about 200 AD. From about 500 BC to about 200 AD, it continued to grow in strength and influence and size and everything. And around 100 to 200 AD, it began to decline. And that decline didn't really finish until about 500 AD, when the city-state of Rome itself, of course, it went out, Rome became an empire, it conquered a lot of area, but around 500 AD, the city itself lost its independence and became subservient again. At the time, there was a mock emperor that was put in place, and it was kind of a mess. But the city pretty much depopulated, and it became a side note, and was no longer of any real significance by 500 AD. The wealthy had abandoned the city. The ones who remained behind were too poor to really leave the city. They had no place to go and no means of getting there. So it took about 700 years for Rome to get to its peak, and it took about 300 years for Rome to die. Now, the U.S. became independent in the mid-1700s, and it peaked. In my way of thinking, the United States peaked about 1950. Since then, since about 1950, the U.S. has been engaged in almost unending, undeclared war. The late 1940s was the last time that the U.S. was in a declared war, and we actually won. But since about 1950s, the United States has been unable to engage in a declared war. Since about 1950, the U.S. has exhausted its treasury. It switched to fiat currency. It debased that currency dramatically. And its elections have become pretty much, they've entirely lost their veil of legitimacy. I mean, that should be obvious to anybody who's watched the 2012 electoral process and the horrible fraud that's taking place in the Republican primaries. But see, that's been happening right along. It's just that most people weren't aware of it. I was seeing this kind of stuff going on in 1988 in the Republican primaries in 88, and I was disgusted by it. But it wasn't public. And we saw it, a lot of this kind of thing happening among the Democrats in 2000 and again in 2004. Well, and really in 2008 as well, in the tricks between Hillary and Barack Obama. You know, Hillary was the original one. Her people were the original ones that brought out the whole birth certificate thing with Obama. So there's all kinds of shenanigans that have been going on in the electoral process. But since about 1950, it's become more and more obvious with each election that the elections themselves are fake, and they're losing their veil of legitimacy. And the wealthy who are not connected to government in the U.S. are beginning to very quickly leave the country. So America took about 200 years to reach its peak, and then it's been in decline for about 60 years. Now, using Rome as the example, we don't have that long. Now, it's not necessarily logical to say because Rome did this, America will do that. That's not really logical. Using the picture of Rome as a substitute for logic, you can't really connect the two. There's nothing really connecting the two, but we can look at the similarities and we can say, you know, well, this if you know, the fall of Rome. Okay, so the old saying is Rome wasn't built in a day and Rome didn't fall in a day. So that's the old saying. Rome wasn't built in a day and Rome didn't fall in a day. Okay, so using that as an example, Rome took, like, 700 years to come to its peak. It took 700 years to build Rome, and it took 300 years for it to die. Well, it took America about 200 years to build it and about 60 years to die. So that actually, proportionately, that's real close to the same. That's a real close comparison. But again, don't be fooled into thinking that this has something to do with morals or with ethics. It doesn't. It's the state. Rome was as corrupt from its beginning as it was when it died, and so was the U.S. Michael W. Dean mentioned yesterday the Whiskey Rebellion, and that's one excellent example. But there are many, there are all kinds of examples of the corruption that was in the United States government starting right from the beginning. It's not morals, and it's not even really the corruption. It's the fact that it's a state. And when you have a government based on this myth of the state, you have a government that's guaranteed to collapse. Okay, anyway, folks, thank you very much for listening. Be sure to get over to badquaker.com. And, well, as I always say at the end of my my little tagline at the end of my podcast, for more on liberty, the zero aggression principle, and property rights, go to badquaker.com. Thank you very much, folks.